Welcome to Refreshing Reflections. I'm Sean Scott. Today reading Chicken Soup for the Soul, Jack Canfield, Mark Victor Hansen, Hennick, and Melody McCarthy. I begin with unkindness, passing on small change. I believe it is the nature of people to be heroes, given a chance. James A. Autry. The pharmacist handed me my prescription, apologized for the wait, and explained that his register had already closed. He asked if I would mind using the register at the front of the store. I told him not to worry and walked up front, where one person was in line ahead of me, a little girl no more than 7 with a bottle of children's Motrin on the counter. She clenched a little green and white striped coin purse closely to her chest. The purse reminded me of the days when, as a child, I played dress-up in my grandma's closet. I'd march around the house in oversized clothes, drenched in costume jewelry and hats and scarves, talking grown-up talk to anyone who would listen. I remembered the thrill one day when I gave a pretend dollar to someone, and he handed back some real coins for me to put into my special purse. "Keep the change," he told me with a wink. Now the clerk rang up the little girl's medicine while she shakily pulled out a coupon, a dollar bill, and some coins. I watched her blush as she tried to count her money, and I could see right away that she was about a dollar short. With a quick wink to the checker, I slipped a dollar bill onto the counter and signaled the clerk to ring up the sale. The child scooped her uncounted change into her coin purse, grabbed her package, and scurried out the door. As I headed to my car, I felt a tug on my shirt. There was the girl, looking up at me with her big brown eyes. She gave me a grin, wrapped her arms around my legs for a long moment, then stretched out her little hand. It was full of coins. "Thank you," she whispered. "That's okay," I answered. I flashed her a smile and a wink. "Keep the change." Nancy Mitchell. Big feet, bigger heart. When deeds speak, words are nothing. African proverb. It was an unseasonably hot day. Everybody, it seemed, was looking for some kind of relief, so an ice cream store was a natural place to stop. A little girl, clutching her money tightly, entered the store. Before she could say a word, the store clerk sharply told her to get outside and read the sign on the door, and stay out until she put on some shoes. She left slowly, and a big man followed her out of the store. He watched as she stood in front of the store and read the sign, "No bare feet." Tears started rolling down her cheeks as she turned and walked away. Just then, the big man called to her. Sitting down on the curb, he took off his size 12 shoes and set them in front of the girl, saying, "Here, you won't be able to walk in these, but if you sort of slide along, you can get your ice cream cone." Then he lifted the little girl up and set her feet into the shoes. "Take your time," he said. "I get tired of moving them around, and it'll feel good to just sit here and eat my ice cream." The shining eyes of the little girl could not be missed as she shuffled up to the counter and ordered her ice cream cone. He was a big man, all right. Big belly, big shoes. But most of all, he had a big heart. Anonymous. From Brian Kavanaugh's The Sower's Seeds. Winning. I believe every person has a heart, and if you can reach it, you can make a difference. Uli Derrickson. His mother told us the story the day after. Kenneth was in junior high school and was excited and eager about participating in a day of Special Olympics events. While his parents watched expectantly from the stands, he ran and won the first race. He was proud of his ribbon and the cheers from the crowd. He ran in the second race. Just at the finish line, when he again would have won, he stopped, then stepped off the track. His parents gently questioned him. Why did you do that, Kenneth? If you had continued running, you would have won another race. Kenneth innocently replied, But, Mom, I already have a ribbon. Billy didn't have a ribbon yet. Clifford and Jerry Furness. Goodness defies the odds. It is raining still. Maybe it is not one of those showers that is here 1 minute and gone the next, as I had so boldly assumed. Maybe none of them are. After all, life in itself is a chain of rainy days, but there are times when not all of us have umbrellas to walk under. Those are the times when we need people who are willing to lend their umbrellas to a wet stranger on a rainy day. I think I'll go for a walk with my umbrella. Sun Young Park. She opened the letter as she strolled up the driveway from the mailbox. As she finished the first paragraph, she stopped in her tracks, unable to focus because of the tears in her eyes. After a few seconds, she lifted her head toward the perfect sky and, for a brief, wonderful moment, she could hear her son singing his favorite song. In the house, she put the mail down and called her husband at the store where he worked to tell him what had just arrived. At first, he was speechless, trying awkwardly to collect his emotions and having some difficulty. "Read it to me," the husband said. She spoke softly and slowly, savoring each word. When she finished, neither said anything for a long time, until finally the husband declared, "There really is a God." 18 months ago, they were living at Children's Hospital in Boston. Their 9-year-old son had been diagnosed with cancer. As if that weren't enough, the father had just been laid off by a high-tech company that was surviving only by downsizing, a 1990s word for unemployment. Like many people affected by such management decisions, the layoff was in an economic death sentence to the household. His wife was a library clerk. In addition to their son, there were 3 other children, girls, ages 7, 5, and 2. Cancer is the most vicious of diseases, consuming the cell of a victim's body without discrimination. It has no conscience either, striking the very young and the very innocent, as well as those much older who at least have managed to see and taste a larger slice of life. Day after day, both parents took turns at the hospital with their sick boy. The doctors and nurses were wonderful and heroic, as they managed to evoke smiles and optimism from those so wounded by the bitter reality of their illness. Their son struck up a friendship with another boy on the floor, a 10-year-old who, like him, loved baseball. And on those dreamy summer nights when the old town team was home, the two of them sat by a window on an upper floor in a hospital ward and listened to games on the radio as they looked at the lights of the ballpark off in the distance, washing across the July sky like some brilliant Milky Way all their own. These 2 sick children became thick as thieves, joined by their passion of the Red Sox, along with the anchor of their cancer. Naturally, their parents became friends too. The other boy was from Connecticut. His parents were trust fund wealthy, but even their affluence could not insulate them from the cargo of grief that attaches itself to anyone with a wounded child. So, this boy's mother and father were deeply touched when the parents of the 9-year-old presented both boys with Red Sox jackets and 2 baseballs signed by Mo Vaughn. We are a land of baseball and miracles in progress, but none of it can impede the nearly inevitable curse of cancer. And so it was that the 9-year-old died on a clear, crisp fall day when his favorite game had long fallen silent from a strike. The combination of hospitalization and unemployment had nearly bankrupted the family, yet they had to fight on for their 3 surviving children. But every day, was like carrying a load of bricks up some steep, never-ending hill. The only job the father found was at a variety store, while his wife simply could not return to work. And on the morning she stopped in her tracks, letter in hand, their home was on the verge of foreclosure as she read that first paragraph. "We will never forget the kindness you showed our son at Children's. God moves in mysterious ways. We are so fortunate. Our son is doing well. We heard about your difficulty from a nurse and want you to accept what we have sent. Your son gave a lot to our son. We think about him every day, and we will still hear his beautiful voice singing his favorite song, The Star-Spangled Banner, when we watch the Red Sox. You gave to us. Now it is time for our family to give in return. May God bless you." They had enclosed $10,000. It is the kind of generous gesture one wounded couple to another forged forever at the edge of a gentle sadness. Mike Barnicle. Hope in a Battle. They say a person needs just these things to be truly happy in this world: someone to love, something to do, and something to hope for. Tom Bodett. I truly believe everyone in their lifetime comes face to face with a bit of magic. It's the kind of magic that reminds you of one single word that can be easily forgotten: hope. One blustery 1992 day, as I walked along the shoreline, I watched waves roll in from a spate of thunderstorms. Trash lined the shore, along with large mounds of seaweed. I don't know what made it catch my eye, but atop those smelly mounds, a large Canadian Club bottle was perched upright. Inside, I spotted a piece of paper, a damp slip curled with lettering on it. I clutched the bottle under my arm and got the message out. It said, "Return to E.L. Cannon, Hollywood, Florida, with a note and your address, and receive $20 U.S. I wrote to one E.L. Cannon and learned that he and his wife had tossed the bottle from a cruise ship about 100 miles off Los Angeles after coming up from the Panama Canal. Soon my husband Jim and I became pen pals with Ed and Mary, who turned out to be delightful, retired world travelers who regularly cruise the planet. To this day, although they are in their 80s, I still have images of them dancing across the ship's deck. We began exchanging short letters. During this time, I read a magazine article and grew intrigued by the country of Belize. I dreamed about its lush tropical jungles, its jaguars, as hundreds of palm-lined caves, islands, peppered inside the second longest barrier reef in the world. I liked that some of the country's descendants had come from a line of British and Scottish pirates who once hid among the caves that laced the aqua-green Caribbean. I shared my dream with Jim, and we decided to go there next year. We collected information and saved money. On a lark, I wrote the Cannons and asked if they'd been there. In response, a huge envelope arrived, and out fell a pile of photos. Mary and Ed standing on a pier in San Pedro, the largest island, Mary posing proudly with her fishing guide, Luz, who was holding a giant barracuda. The Cannons had been visiting San Pedro 3 times a year for more than 2 decades. This seems so ironic that we agreed Belize would be the perfect place to meet. We planned our trip for February and decided to meet at the only hotel where the Cannon stayed, because its main owner, Celie, was like a daughter. Meeting absolute strangers in this way seemed remarkable, but that's only the beginning. In late March, I drove home from my reporting job when I noticed a cloud fogging my right eye. I lost about 25% of my vision. By week's end, I was totally blind in that eye. My vision returned in a few days, but in mid-June, after some tests, the doctors delivered the news that I had multiple sclerosis. This neurological disease is unpredictable and affects each individual so differently. Anything could happen. From tingling to numbness, from blindness to total paralysis. No person reacts the same way to MS, an illness that's like a short circuit to the brain. I went into a tailspin, became angry, depressed, and moody. I was exhausted every day. I dragged myself to work and quit writing the canons. I decided not to go to Belize. We hadn't saved enough money anyway. 4 months went by, and finally I responded to some of the canons' letters. I told them about the multiple sclerosis and that we wouldn't join them after all. Then came a cold and unforgettable November night. When I came home, I smelled the familiar aroma of garlic and vegetables, and Jim was cooking. I was feeling pretty miserable when I spotted a yellow envelope on the table. Jim looked up from the stove and with a large smile and said, "Read it." "Dear Diana and Jim, we received your letter the day we left for Florida, and we were very sorry to hear about your illness. It so happens we have a niece who has a travel agency in a suburb of Cleveland, and she has arranged for 2 round-trip tickets from Los Angeles to San Pedro for you. They will be free, no charge, and will be just the medicine you need. A week or so in San Pedro, Belize. Congratulations. You have won the San Pedro Lotto." I looked at my husband. "Let's go," he shouted happily. But somehow I just couldn't accept such a gesture. I was raised to give, not take. We agreed I would talk to my father because we were close and he always had good advice. The prospect of talking to him, however, made us cringe. We knew the trip was doomed. My father was a man who loved to give to people, but whose pride wouldn't allow him to accept such an offer. But my father said the canons wanted to do this, or they would never have offered. "You should go and consider it one of the greatest gifts anybody has ever given you." I was stunned. What he said was so true. This was a gift of hope. And it became one that I would cling to and remember for the rest of my life. 2 months before our trip, 5 days before Christmas, my father died. It was 2 days after the last time I saw him, and again, I was swallowed by a deep depression. The only thing I had left in my life, I believed, was the gift. When we arrived in the sandy streets of San Pedro, we met the canons on the hotel porch they call Happy Corner. Eddie and I listened to the waves as they roared over the reef. I talked about my father and he talked about his. I was in the right place for healing, surrounded by an emerald sea, where I would snorkel for the first time in my life and see the ocean's underwater treasures, deep caverns, fish of brilliant colors, seahorses, and schools of squid. Eddie told me something he lived by. In this life, always give yourself something to look forward to. And I have been doing that ever since. In 1995, we returned to the island for a reunion with the canons. We shared the bottle story with other tourists who came to Happy Corner and toasted the canons. When we arrived home, we received letters from everyone we met. They all wanted to remember the bottle story. I can't thank the canons enough. Their message in a bottle had returned my hope, and still does to this day. Diana Chapman. Cookies Forgotten and Forgiven. As I sat perched in the second floor window of our brick schoolhouse that afternoon, my heart began to sink further with each passing car. This was a day I'd looked forward to for weeks. Miss Pace's 4th grade end-of-the-year party. Miss Pace had kept a running countdown on the blackboard all that week, and our class of 9-year-olds had bordered on insurrection by the time the much-anticipated party Friday had arrived. I had happily volunteered my mother when Miss Pace requested cookie volunteers. Mom's chocolate chips reigned supreme on our block, and I'd know they'd be a hit with my classmates. But 2 o'clock passed, and there was no sign of her. Most of the other mothers had already come and gone, dropping off their offerings of punch and crackers, chips, cupcakes, and brownies. My mother was missing in action. "Don't worry, Robbie. She'll be along soon," Miss Pace said, as I gazed forlornly down the street. I looked at the wall clock just in time to see its black minute hand shift to 5:30. Around me, the noisy party raged on, but I wouldn't budge from my window watch post. Miss Pace did her best to coax me away, but I stayed put, holding out hope that the familiar family car would round the corner, carrying my rightfully embarrassed mother with a tin of her famous cookies tucked under her arm. The 3 o'clock bell soon jolted me from my thoughts, and I dejectedly grabbed my book bag from my desk and shuffled out the door for home. On the 4-block walk to our house, I plotted my revenge. I would slam the front door upon entering, refuse to return her hug when she rushed over to me, and vow never to speak to her again. The house was empty when I arrived, and I looked for a note on the refrigerator that might explain my mother's absence, but found none. My chin quivered with a mixture of heartbreak and rage. For the first time in my life, my mother had let me down. I was lying face down on my bed upstairs when I heard her come through the front door. "Robbie," she called out, a bit urgently, "where are you?" I could then hear her darting frantically from room to room, wondering where I could be. I remained silent. In a moment, she mounted the steps, the sounds of her footsteps quickening as she ascended the staircase. When she entered my room and sat beside me on my bed, I didn't move, but instead stared blankly into my pillow, refusing to acknowledge her presence. "I'm so sorry, honey," she said. "I just forgot. I got busy and forgot. Plain and simple." I still didn't move. "Don't forgive her," I told myself. "She humiliated you. She forgot you. Make her pay." Then my mother did something completely unexpected. She began to laugh. I could feel her shudder as the laughter shook her. It began quietly at first and then increased in its velocity and volume. I was incredulous. How could she laugh at a time like this? I rolled over and faced her, ready to let her see the rage and disappointment in my eyes. But my mother wasn't laughing at all. She was crying. "I'm so sorry," she sobbed softly. "I let you down. I let my little boy down." She sank down on the bed and began to weep like a little girl. I was dumbstruck. I had never seen my mother cry. To my understanding, mothers weren't supposed to. I wondered if this was how I looked to her when I cried. I desperately tried to recall her own soothing words from times past when I had skinned knees or stubbed toes, times when she knew just the right thing to say. But in that moment of tearful plight, words of profoundly abandoned me like a worn-out shoe. "It's okay, Mom," I stammered as I reached out and gently stroked her hair. "We didn't even need those cookies. There was plenty of stuff to eat. Don't cry. It's all right. Really." My words, as inadequate as they sounded to me, prompted my mother to sit up. She wiped her eyes, and a slight smile began to crease her tear-stained cheeks. I smiled back awkwardly, and then she pulled me to her. We didn't say another word. We just held each other in a long, silent embrace. When we came to the point where I would usually pull away, I decided that this time I could hold on, perhaps just a little bit longer. Robert Tate Miller. Well, we are out of time, but I would like to leave you with a quote by Khalil Gibran. A chemist who can extract from his heart's element compassion, respect, longing, patience, regret, surprise, and forgiveness, and compound them into one, can create that atom, which is called love. Thank you for listening. I'm Sean Scott, and until next time, may we all be refreshed.